It is with great pleasure that I call upon Mr. Christopher Davis, the President of the Chambers Union, to oppose that motion.
I would first, Mr. Chairman, sir, like to... Oh, Mr. Evans is back again. I would first like to thank you, sir, for inviting me here to speak tonight, and I would also like to congratulate Mr. McCormick on his election. I must say that since being here, I am very impressed by the essentially religious atmosphere of the Oxford Union. In the President's room, they hang together pictures of Eric Abrahams and Neil McCormick. And between them, there stands a crucifix. I must also congratulate Mr. Abrahams on a very passionate speech, which he ran for the whole gamut of human emotions from A to B. However, I must say that I found his arguments a little obscure. Indeed, I saw them as through a fast darkly. Oxford, indeed, sir, is the only place where sound travels faster than light. It was... It was with great relief that I heard that Lord Stonham was to speak on this side of the House, for I had feared that speaking alongside two such prominent Conservatives, I should automatically be associated with their party. The party of the long connives, the party of deceit. Where a man is apt to speak with his tongue in someone else's cheek. A party led by a man whose election to Parliament caused a vacancy both in the Lords and in the Commons. He may not be a great light, but he's a very good candlestick. A man chosen by that Darwinian process of natural selection by which the Tory party obtains its leaders. I'm afraid this time they have a freak mutation. I must also first refute a malicious rumour put around by Mr. Abrahams that I am a Liberal. This cannot be true, since the Liberal Party does not exist anymore. At one time, the Liberal Party existed as a party occurring by definition to the right of the Labour Party, but to the left of the Conservative Party. Unfortunately, the Conservative Party moved left, the Labour Party moved right. And they now occupy what is mathematically an imaginary point in space. No, sir, I will also disassociate myself from that party of the glibs and the ad-libs, the party whose policy is the Gladstone bag. You can fill it up with rubbish and carry it back and forth across the political stage. And so, Mr. President, sir, to the motion, which... which consists of two separate and unfortunate value statements, two statements, as you have stressed yourself, of general principle. I want to look at the meaning of the first of these and draw conclusions which I think can be applied to both of them, since they are unsatisfactory basically for the same reasons. And I would stress that this is a statement of general principle, and I would argue that it is illicit to argue that because in certain select instances, we've already been told about South Africa, and we've already been told about the Second World War, which in fact the two that I predicted would be used, We've already been told about these, but I put it to you that it is not permissible on the basis of two exceptional circumstances to draw a general principle as strong and as definite as this one. You cannot use a limited number of explosive or revolutionary situations to justify a motion that is as sweeping and as total as extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. This is a statement that comes perilously close to asserting, firstly, that extremism is justified in all circumstances where liberty is felt to be threatened, and the key word is felt to be threatened. It's already well to say that in 1939 that liberty was actually threatened in a big way by the German army. But if one takes this motion as it stands, this implies that under all circumstances where you feel there is a threat that may in fact be non-existent, then you are justified in being extreme in the defense of what you consider to be liberty. And the second feature, which I think is against this assumption, is that it implies that the adverse side effects of extremism, the violence, the deprivations, and the witch hunting, are of no consequence. It ignores them. What I would put to you is that whilst extremism in the defense of liberty may sometimes be a cruel necessity, as in the Second World War, it is still a vice. It is still the lesser of two evils. This is the key thing. It no longer becomes no vice. It no longer becomes something that we can just assume. It becomes the lesser of two evils that is forced upon us by circumstances. And it is certainly not a means of action that should be lightly used or widely used. If it is no vice, it is something that one can just pick up and use as it takes one, as the mood takes one. It's something that one should use only when one has to, and then after a great deal of consideration concerning the question of which is the greater evil under the circumstances. The difficulty, which Mr. Abrams again has already drawn attention to, with words like justice, like the capital J, and liberty taken in isolation, is, as I think will become apparent during the debate, is that they mean different things to different groups of people. I'm afraid Mr. Abrams' definition didn't satisfy me, and since I came plunk in the middle of the political spectrum that he outlined, I hardly see how the people at either one end or the other could have been satisfied. Now, even if we make the simplest of all possible assumptions, if we assume that all men could agree as to what constituted true justice or true liberty, that there was, if you like, a single scalar lump of stuff called liberty. If we could assume this, even then one would have to answer one basic question. How much? It's not just saying extremism in the defense of liberty. One has to say extremism in the defense of how much liberty before one gets any further. How much of this particular value does one consider desirable in a society? Liberty is only one social value. If we are extreme in our defense of liberty, then presumably in our defense of liberty, we are prepared to neglect or even to ride roughshod over the other social values, such as equality or prosperity or solidarity, in order to obtain for each of us the maximum amount of liberty. One just goes for liberty bald-headed, neglecting the other values, which do not necessarily come in the train of liberty. Or at any rate, at its mildest form, one is prepared to ossify the social system in order to defend and preserve all existing liberties. It says, in the defense of liberty. In a given society, one has certain things which the people in that society consider as their liberty. The implication is that under no circumstances will one permit an inroad into those liberties, however great the gain might be in other spheres. I cannot, under any circumstances, accept this. And similarly, I think that to eschew moderation in the pursuit of justice is possibly to neglect questions such as the need for order and stability. If, for example, one comes across people who argue that it is unjust ever to punish an innocent person. And if one were to rigorously apply a tenet of this kind, if one were, if you like, to pursue justice in this sense to an extreme limit, then nobody'd ever be convicted, and the system would break down completely. What one has to realize is that the system is complex. The goals that we follow have to be complex. They have to be many. And therefore, to be extreme in the pursuit of any one of them is to neglect the others, with consequent bad features for the society in which we live. Liberty and justice are not the sole social values. The implication of this motion is that they alone are significant. I think one way in which people get to this point is by defining liberty and justice in terms so all-embracing that they subsume all other social values. The word then becomes meaningless, because liberty merely becomes a collective term for all good things. On this definition, Mr. President, sir, you are a liberty. And indeed, indeed, since all good things come to an end, one day you will be a dead liberty. May I then offer you the epitaph of my cousin John Longbottom? Vita brevis est, ars longa. Now, even the question is even more complex than this. I mean, this is on the simple assumption. But if one looks into the greater complexities of meaning of this world, where the trouble really arises is that people differ in their ideas of what constitutes liberty, or more accurately, of what liberties people are entitled to, since, of course, liberty is a very complex quantity. Each group has its own definition of liberty, which will be enmeshed in its own particular social philosophy or social ethic. And the motion really reduces to extremism in the defense of liberty as defined by me is no vice. Because anybody who says this is obviously acting on his own notion of what constitutes liberty. One has to see this question in a context of social action. One cannot just regard liberty and action as two completely separate things that one can discuss separately. One has to consider this decision of a person who feels his own concept of liberty to be threatened, how he should act under those circumstances. Should he be extreme? This is the basic question. Now, for one group, true liberty may be being permitted to participate in activities which, for various reasons, I shall specify A, B, C, and D, whereas another group may just turn round to them and say, well, no, this is rubbish. Liberty consists of being permitted to participate in activities E, F, G, and H. Now, I won't go on in case I run out of an alphabet, but I think you get the point. For example, in the United States, the liberty of an individual to own private productive property is considered a basic component of liberty. If you argued in the United States that one could have capital L for liberty without any property rights at all, then one would just be shouted down. Whereas on the other hand, in the Soviet Union, the opposite is true. This is not considered a basic component of capital L for liberty. It's considered a mere inferior bourgeois liberty. And it's always that one has to consider that these notions do in fact differ. Or more locally, for a conservative, liberty includes the right to manufacture steel. Whereas I feel that to leave the steel industry in the hands of men who never see a blast furnace until after they are dead is not a liberty this country can afford. In this case, one is deliberately restricting a certain kind of liberty in the interests of economic prosperity. And this is a question that always has to be settled. One cannot just take liberty and say, well, if you've got liberty, you've got everything else. I mean, what happens, for example, if you're fighting an external war? How does one then decide whether or not to censure the press? I mean, how is this question decided? If not, we're just saying, right, we'll be extreme. I mean, the question then is, I mean, you either have no restrictions at all, or on the other hand, you restrict them completely. It's a question that has to be settled in a fairly pragmatic manner. So that one now comes to the point where one has to settle these differences of opinion as to what constitutes true liberty. And it's no good blindly asserting on one side or the other that my notion of liberty is as pure as the driven slush and therefore must prevail. This is no argument, because others with equally contradictory views may turn around and say, ah yes, but my motives are equally pure and my definition of liberty is equally valid. Yet in practice, these definitions of liberty may be opposed and even completely contradictory. I think basically there are two ways of settling this difference of opinion as to what constitutes liberty. And I would stress that this is a question of settling a difference of opinion. The one method, the method that I would advocate, is that of political bargaining, that of compromise, that, if you like, of accepting less than one's full demands when it comes to the crunch. And this includes something such as the notion and implementation of liberty. Now the other alternative to this is merely to hammer on the table and shout, I am right. If you accept this method in defense of your concept of liberty, then equally well, you must expect other groups to adopt the same attitude. It's no good Mr. Abrams saying that the Goldwater didn't really think this because his notion of liberty was wrong, or because there was no threat to it, which is merely postponing the definitional problem from one word to another. What one has to admit is that Goldwater had a concept of liberty, and he was genuinely prepared to be extreme in his defense of it. Now, it may have been a crackpot concept of liberty, but it was a concept of liberty as he saw the word. And I don't think that one can turn round and sort of dogmatically say, I am right on this matter. It's just something that has to be thrashed out. This, basically, this motion attempts to provide a simple answer to complex problems. It's the kind of motion that says, ah, if only we fight hard enough for our liberty, which is a good thing, unspecified, then all our problems will be solved. And this strikes me as a solution as too simple, and therefore as silly, irrelevant, and dangerous. It's as silly and as irrelevant and dangerous as the kind, sir.
As a pure matter of interest, what possible answer would the honourable member supply to the question in, let us say, South Africa or Southern Rhodesia? What would be your answer?
My answer would be, shoot the bastard. All the bastards. Under this circumstance, I think it is perfectly consistent for me to say that as happened in the Cambridge debate, that a violent revolution under these circumstances would be justified. But this does not justify the general principle. This is my point. Extremism in the defense of liberty can be justified. But to say it's no vice, this is saying that under all circumstances, this is a course of action that one ought to take. This is what no vice means. It means that there is nothing wrong with it under any circumstances. And even while advocating such a revolutionary standpoint under such circumstances, I would still be forced to admit that my actions would have unfortunate consequences. And therefore I would be prepared to admit that my actions might be called a vice. There might be a justifiable vice, they're a vice nevertheless. I mean, the law, as far as I'm concerned, that says thou shalt not kill, you can get round it okay for the sake of convenience.
But according
to your definition, the law does not say thou shalt not kill bastards. That, sir, depends on whether they are by birth or by vocation. This motion is a part of the kind of simple paradises that we are offered from various sides today. From the Marxists, we are offered the mystical trinity of thesis, antithesis, and paralysis. By the Welsh nationalists, we are offered 3 acres and a Welsh-speaking cow. And by various other people in the fields of molecular theology, which is the science of converting the unknowable into the not worth knowing, by all these people, we are offered simple solutions. And these solutions, in this instance, and these other solutions are more or less on a par with this one. They're just as absurd. These solutions are an attempt to dispel the particular anxieties of our society by postulating some mysterious threat to our liberty, some actual or potential tyrant or subverter. And the sort of argument is that if we sweep away the tyrant who threatens our liberty, if we get the bandwagons in a circle, then everything will be wonderful. This is a means that when one is faced with a problem where there's a great deal of uncertainty, where there are a great deal of cross-cutting issues, where one isn't quite sure what one ought to do, and one hammers on the table, one gives out a slogan of this kind that has emotional appeal, that has a capital L and a capital J, that in this way one tries to introduce a measure of security. But it's a dishonest solution. Now I'm afraid that we on this side of the house cannot offer you any simple or emotionally satisfying slogans of which this is an example. We cannot offer you clear enemies or clear scapegoats, as the case may be. All I'm afraid that we can offer you in the solution of any problem is patient effort and difficult progress towards many goals in a complex world of very few certainties. The path of moderation is not as easy or as glamorous as that of extremism, but it is an honest path. It is an attempt to face up to realities, not to project all the evil and mistakes in the world onto one particular enemy. I am convinced that it's only through moderation, only by taking this path, that one can get to a better world. In some few circumstances, one may be justified in saying that we shall use extremism. But this is not the point at issue. The point at issue is, on the one hand, under those circumstances where one is forced to use extremism, is it no vice? Is it in no sense a vice? Is it in no sense a vice to wage war, however justified? Can one honestly say that a war has ever been fought that was no vice, where there was nothing wrong in the motives or the methods used by the protagonists of that war? Maybe justified, but certainly not no vice. That is to say, it is some vice. This is the problem that faces us. And also, we are faced by a world in which most of the problems stem from complicated situations. There is nobody whom we can be extreme against in the defense of our liberty. The only way we can safeguard it is by watching carefully and, as I say, making slow progress toward a number of goals of which liberty is only one. Thank you.